Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to MoMA. My name is Laura Bayless. I work here in the Education Department. It is a pleasure to see all of you here today, and it's a delight to have this glorious weather for a wonderful event dedicated to Frank O'Hara. This is an event that's part of our series called Modern Poets, and today's event, as you know, is Frank O'Hara Selected Poems at Lunchtime. And we are really excited to celebrate his tradition of writing poems on his lunch breaks while he worked at MoMA. And in the same spirit, today's participating poets who are sitting right here, Leanne Brown, Dan Chasen, Vincent Katz, Hetty Jones, and Philip Schultz, were also asked to compose their own lunchtime poems, in addition to reading works from Selected Poems, which was recently published by Knopf. And actually following the reading, you can buy some of those books over here. We have Selected Poems as well as In Memory of My Feelings for sale. Before we get started, I just wanted to thank Alice Quinn and Rob Casper at the Poetry Society of America, and Sarah Robinson and Deb Garrison at Knopf for being such great collaborators on this program. And of course, our amazing poets. We're so excited to have all of them here. And actually, on the back of your programs, you can find their bios, so you can find more information about them there. I also want to thank a couple of other people whose creativity and assistance were so important to making today's program happen. Stephanie Hess, Audrey Chan, and our AV and engineering staff from MoMA. Tracy Williams and Joe Farelli from Cafe 2 for letting us sit in this great shady space and for offering us their food. The Contemporary Arts Council of the Museum of Modern Art for their support of this program. And finally, Maureen O'Hara for her amazing enthusiasm for poetry, for our programs, and of course for her legendary brother. So I'm going to welcome her. She's going to say a few words and then we're going to get started. And thank you for coming.
I'd like to read an excerpt from Larry Rivers' memoir. Larry Rivers' memoir. I first met Larry Rivers in 1950 when I first started coming down to New York from Harvard for weekends. Larry was in Europe and friends had said we would like each other. Finally, at, for me, a very literary cocktail party at John Ashbery's, we did meet. And we did like each other. I thought he was crazy, and he thought I was even crazier. I was very shy, which he thought was intelligence. He was garrulous, which I assumed was brilliance. And on such misinterpretations, thank heavens, many a friendship is based. On the other hand, perhaps it was not a misinterpretation. Certain of my literary heroes of the partisan review variety present at the party paled in significance when I met Larry, and through these years have remained pale, while Larry has been something of a hero to me, which would seem to make me intelligent and Larry brilliant. Who knows? The milieu of those days, and it's funny to think of them in such a way, since they are so recent, seems odd now. We were all in our early 20s, John Ashbery, Barbara Guest, Kenneth Koch, and I, being poets, divided our time between the literary bar, the San Remo, and the artist's bar, the Cedar Tavern. In the San Remo, we argued and gossiped. In the Cedar, we often wrote poems while listening to the painters argue and gossip. So far as I know, nobody painted in the San Remo while they listened to the writers argue. An interesting sidelight to those social activities was that for most of us non-academic and indeed non-literary poets, in the sense of the American scene at the time, the painters were the only generous audience for our poetry. And most of us read first publicly in the art galleries or at the club. The literary establishment cared about as much for our work as the Frick cared for Pollock and de Kooning. Not that we cared any more about establishments than they did, all of the disinterested parties being honorable men. Then there was a great respect for anyone who did anything marvelous. When Larry introduced me to de Kooning, I nearly got sick, as I almost did when I met Auden. If Jackson Pollock tore the door off the men's room at the Cedar, It was something he just did and was interesting, not an annoyance. You could see into it anyway, and besides, there was then a sense of genius. Or what Klein used to call the dream. Newman was at that time considered a temporarily silent oracle. Being ill, Ad Reinhardt, the most shrewd critic of the emergent art world. Maya Shapiro, a god, and Alfred Barr right up there alongside him, but more distant. Holder Cahill, another god, but one who had abdicated to become more interested in the thing we're doing. Clement Greenberg, the discoverer, Harold Rosenberg, the analyzer, and so on and so on. Tom Hess had written the important book. Elaine de Kooning was the white goddess, and she knew everything. Told little of it, though. She talked a lot, and we adored and adore her. She is graceful. It is interesting to think of 1950 to 52 in the styles of a whole group of young artists whom I knew rather intimately. It was a liberal education on top of an academic one. Larry was chiefly involved with Bonnard and Renoir at first, later Manet and Soutine. Joan Mitchell, Duchamp. Mike Goldberg, Cezanne, Villon, de Kooning. Helen Frankenthaler, Pollock, Miro, Mike Goldberg, Cezanne, Villon, de Kooning, Nell Blaine, Elion, Hartigan, Pollock, Gustin, Harry Jackson, a lot of Matisse with a little German expressionism, Jane Freilacher, a more subtle combination of Soutine with some Monticelli and Moreau appearing through the paint. The impact of the new American painting on the group was being avoided rather self-consciously rather than exploited. If you live in a studio next to Brancusi, you try to think about Poussin. If you drink with Klein, you tend to do your black and whites in pencil on paper. The artists I knew at the time knew perfectly well who was great, and they weren't going to begin to imitate their works. When someone did a false Clifford Still or Rothko, it was talked about for weeks. They hadn't read Sartre's Being or Nothingness for nothing. And now, I would like to thank everyone at the Museum of Modern Art for inviting us to celebrate Frank's new selected poems today in this beautiful sculpture garden. Thanks to Laura Bayless and everyone at the museum for all the special attention and care making this happen. And thanks to Alice Quinn for the brilliant idea to celebrate Frank's poems at lunchtime, and to Rob Casper and everyone at the Poetry Society. I wish to thank Mark Ford, who could not be here to celebrate with us. His selection is remarkable, and he has been a pleasure to work with on two books of Frank's poems. And thanks to Deborah Garrison, Frank's wonderful editor at Knopf, and everyone during these years since Judith Jones and Bob Gottlieb worked with Don Allen and me on the collected poems and the first selected poems. And of course, thanks to City Lights for keeping Frank's lunch poems in print. If Frank were here today, he would be delighted. His friends and colleagues at the museum have been splendid during all these many years. Kynaston McShine and Bill Berkson always worked with him during many projects. And Rennie Darnancourt, the director of the museum, was the most elegant and generous friend. When I was in New Hampshire at the time of the accident, and until my brother from Chicago and I were able to get to the hospital, Rennie Darnancourt made sure that Frank had round-the-clock nursing. Frank was curator for the Robert Motherwell exhibition at the MoMA in 1965, and Frank curated and wrote the catalog for the David Smith exhibition that traveled to Europe in 1966. He curated and wrote the catalog for the Nakian exhibition that opened at MoMA in June 1966. And here, and this will be my last reading, is the excerpt from a letter that Frank wrote to Ruben Nakian on July 19th, 1966. Dear Ruben, the show is still looking beautiful, and everyone is very happy. Even those white pedestals seem to be holding their own against the feet of your nearsighted fans. The only untoward thing that's happened so far is that last Sunday, an overardent young lady got too intense about the small voyage to Crete in the garden near the goddess, and it fell backwards into the ivy. Surely the most comfortable rest a Europa has ever had. Of course, the sculpture is completely unharmed. It went, pedestal and all. So we have put a broader base around the bottom of the pedestal and fixed it to the marble so it can't keel over again, even if someone leans on it. This caused a fury similar to that when a baby is dropped out a sixth floor window. But I thought it was quite funny that she merely leaned back into the ivy. Your ladies are always laying down. Or is it lying down? I hope Charlie has relayed some of the many compliments to you. I was especially pleased that Helen Frankenthaler and Bob Motherwell came separately and called separately to say how great they thought your work is. Since I know them well and they are no mealy mouths, Helen the same day told Marlborough that she thought their group show was full of junk. And Linda and Giorgio Cavallon came back again and loved it. I also especially liked Peter Sheldahl's review in the Village Voice, both for what it said and because he is a very gifted young poet, the editor of a very good poetry little magazine called Mother. You got the Avant-Garde and Newsweek, and René Darnoncourt is back from Mexico and crazy about the exhibition. He had seen several of the works before. He left the museum on business, but not the show completed. I trust you realize what a great joy it was for me to work on the show and to spend so much time with your work, with you and Larry and Charlie. It was a great privilege for me, and I hope you are even more proud of it than I am because you did it. Thank you, Ruben. Frank.
Hi, thank you very much for inviting me today. I'm Leanne Brown. I picked to read Digression on number 1, 1948. I thought it would be very appropriate for MoMA. I am ill today, but I am not too ill. I am not ill at all. It is a perfect day, warm for winter, cold for fall, a fine day for seeing. I see ceramics during lunch hour by Miró, and I see the sea by Léger, light, complicated Metzingers, and a rude awakening by Browner, a little table by Picasso, pink. I am tired today, but I'm not too tired. I'm not tired at all. There is the Pollock, white, harm will not fall, his perfect hand, and the many short voyages, they'll never fence the silver range. Stars are out, and there is sea enough beneath the glistening earth to bear me toward the future, which is not so dark. I see. And this is the one that you might have seen an excerpt on the fence down by the Palm Court near the World Trade Center. Meditations in an emergency. Am I to become profligate as if I were a blonde, or religious as if I were French? Each time my heart is broken, it makes me feel more adventurous, and how the names keep recurring on that interminable list. But one of these days, there'll be nothing left with which to venture forth. Why should I share you? Why don't you just get rid of someone else for a change? I am the least difficult of men. All I want is boundless love. Even trees understand me. Good heavens, I lie under them too, don't I? I'm just like a pile of leaves. However, I have never clogged myself with the praises of pastoral life, nor with nostalgia for an innocent past of perverted acts and pastures. No, one need never leave the confines of New York to get all the greenery one wishes. I can't even enjoy a blade of grass unless I know there's a subway handy, or a record store, or some other sign that people do not totally regret life. It is more important to affirm the least sincere. The clouds get enough attention as it is, and even they continue to pass. Do they know what they're missing? Uh-huh. My eyes are vague blue, like the sky, and change all the time. They are indiscriminate but fleeting, entirely specific and disloyal, so that no one trusts me. I am always looking away, or again, at something after it has given me up. It makes me restless, and that makes me unhappy, but I cannot keep them still. If only I had gray, green, black, brown, yellow eyes, I would stay at home and do something. It's not that I'm curious. On the contrary, I am bored. But it's my duty to be attentive. I am needed by things as the sky must be above the earth. And lately, so great has their anxiety become, I can spare myself little sleep. Now there is only one man I love to kiss when he is unshaven. Heterosexuality, you are inexorably approaching. How discourage her. Saint Serapion, I wrap myself in the robes of your whiteness, which is like midnight in Dostoevsky. How am I to become a legend, my dear? I've tried love, but that hides you in the bosom of another, and I'm always springing forth from it like the lotus, the ecstasy of always bursting forth. But one must not be distracted by it, or like a hyacinth, to keep the filth of life away. Yes, there, even in the heart, where the filth is pumped in and slanders and pollutes and determines, I will my will, though I may become famous for a mysterious vacancy in that department, that greenhouse. Destroy yourself if you don't know. It is easy to be beautiful. It is difficult to appear so. I admire you, beloved, for the trap you've set. It's like a final chapter no one reads because the plot is over. Fanny Brown is run away, scampered off with a cornet of horse. I do love that little minx and hope she may be happy, though she has vexed me by this exploit a little too. Poor little Chechina, or FB, as we used to call her. I wish she had a good whipping and 10,000 pounds, Mrs. Thrall. I've got to get out of here. I chose a piece of shawl in my dirtiest suntans. I'll be back. I'll reemerge defeated from the valley. You don't want me to go where you go, so I go where you don't want me to. It's only afternoon. There's a lot ahead. There won't be any mail downstairs. Turning, I spit in the lock, and the knob turns. Poem. Lana Turner has collapsed. I was trotting along, and suddenly it started raining and snowing, and you said it was hailing, but hailing hits you on the head hard, so it was really snowing and raining, and I was in such a hurry to meet you, but the traffic was acting exactly like the sky, and suddenly I see a headline. Lana Turner has collapsed. There is no snow in Hollywood. There is no rain in California. I have been to lots of parties and acted perfectly disgraceful, but I never actually collapsed. Oh, Lana Turner, we love you. Get up. Ode to Joy. We shall have everything we want, and there'll be no more dying. On the pretty plains or in the supper clubs, for our symbol will acknowledge vulgar materialistic laughter over an insatiable sexual appetite. And the streets will be filled with racing forms, and the photographs of murderers and narcissists and movie stars will swell from the walls and books alive in steaming rooms to press against our burning flesh, not once but interminably, as water flows downhill into the full-lipped basin. And the adder dives for the ultimate ostrich egg, and the feather cushion preens beneath a reclining monolith, the sweating with post-exertion visibility and sweetness near the grave of love. No more dying. We shall see the grave of love as a lovely sight and temporary near the elm that spells the lovers' names in roots, and there'll be no more music but the ears and lips, and no more wit but tongues and ears, and no more drums but ears to thighs as evening signals nudities unknown to ancestors' imaginations. And the imagination itself will stagger like a tired paramour of ivory under the sculptural necessities of lust that never falters, like a 6-mile runner from Sweden or Liberia, covered with gold as lava flows up and over the far down somnolent cities. Abdication and the hermit always wanting to be lone is lone at last, and the weight of external heat crushes the heat-hating Puritan, whose self-defeating vice becomes a proper sepulcher at last that love may live. Buildings will go up into the dizzy air as love itself goes in and up the reeling life that it has chosen for once or all, while in the sky a feeling of intemperate fondness will excite the birds to swoop and veer like flies crawling across absorbed limbs that weep a pearly perspiration on the sheets of brief attention, and the hairs dry out that summon anxious declarations of the organs as they rise like buildings to the needs of temporary neighbors, pouring hunger through the heart to feed desire in intravenous ways, like the ways of gods with humans in the innocent combination of light and flesh, or in the legends ride their heroes through the dark to found great cities where all life is possible to maintain as long as time, which wants us to remain for cocktails in a bar and after dinner. Let us live with it. No more dying. I'm going to end with a pair. My favorite Frank O'Hara poem of all time. It's an acrostic of Vincent Warren's name down the front. And I just love the headlong feel. It really helps me write. You are gorgeous, and I'm coming. Vaguely, I hear the purple roar of the torn down Third Avenue L. It sways slightly but firmly like a hand or a golden downed thigh. Normally, I don't think of sounds as colored unless I'm feeling corrupt, concrete, Rimbaud, obscurity of emotion, which is simple and very definite, even lasting. Yes, it may be that dark and purifying wave, the death of boredom, nearing the heights of themselves, may destroy you in the pure air, to be further complicated, confused, empty but refilling, exposed to light. With the past falling away as an acceleration of nerves, thundering and shaking, aims its aggregating force like the metro towards a realm of encircling travel, rending the sound of adventure and becoming ultimately local and intimate, repeating the phrases of an old romance which is constantly renewed by the endless originality of human loss, the air, the stumbling quiet of breathing, newly the heaven stars all out. We are all for the captured time of our being. And I wrote, you are not gorgeous and I'm coming anyway. You are gorgeous and I am not getting to know you any better. I feel broken into, I feel drenched, dreamed with the Woolworth's worth of dime store socks, photographed and networked up a raccoon's nest, not here in the city but in the Ile de la Cité, hungry for some foreign country in the middle of my jury duty crawl, into bed, exhumed from Bjork's champagne toast to all of Iceland's fairy cultures recorded as the doors swing open and shut. Of course you are gorgeous, and I am coming. It happens every day, and then I fall into the crick again, spattered with immediate boredom, feeding two boys, not one, and neither of them hitting home. Transposed to his Trappist ringers, Nick called this morning from Assisi, last words as the phone card ran out, blinking from 600 lira down. See you in the next life. Thanks.
Yeah. That always has to happen. Very good.
Got to get it real down low. Thanks, everybody, for coming out. Thanks to everyone who organized this. I'm going to read Frank's poems sort of in order that they were written. So I'll start with the earliest, which is called Today. Oh, kangaroos, sequins, chocolates, sodas. You really are beautiful. Pearls, harmonicas, jujubes, aspirins. All the stuff they've always talked about still makes a poem a surprise. These things are with us every day, even on beachheads and beers. They do have meaning. They're strong as rocks. This is called Walking to Work. It's going to be the sunny side from now on. Get out, all of you. This is my traffic over the night, and how should I range my pride each oceanic morning like a cutter if I confuse the dark world as round, round who in my eyes that morning saves nothing from nobody? I'm becoming the street. Who are you in love with? Me? Straight against the light I cross. This is just called Poem. It's from 1956. Instant coffee with slightly sour cream in it and a phone call to the beyond, which doesn't seem to be coming any nearer. Ah, Daddy, I want to stay drunk many days on the poetry of a new friend, my life held precariously in the seeing hands of others, there and my impossibilities. Is this love, now that the first love has finally died, where there were no impossibilities? Oh, and here's the famous one called The Day Lady Died. I typed that poem, and we published it in Eugen. It's 12:20 in New York, a Friday, 3 days after Bastille Day. Yes, it is 1959, and I go get a shoe shine because I will get off the 419 in East Hampton at 7:15 and then go straight to dinner, and I don't know the people who will feed me. I walk up the muggy street beginning to sun and have a hamburger and a malted and buy an ugly New World writing to see what the poets in Ghana are doing these days. I go on to the bank and Miss Stillwagon, first name Linda, I once heard, doesn't even look up my balance for once in her life. And in the Golden Griffin, I get a little Verlaine for Patsy with drawings by Bonnard, although I do think of Hesiod translate Richmond Lattimore, or Brendan Behan's new play, or Le Balcon, or Les Nègres, Virginie, but I don't. I stick with Verlaine after practically going to sleep with quandariness. And for Mike, I just stroll into the Park Lane liquor store and ask for a bottle of Strega. And then I go back where I came from, to Sixth Avenue, and the tobacconist in the Ziegfeld Theater, and casually ask for a carton of Gauloise and a carton of Picayunes and a New York Post with her face on it. And I am sweating a lot by now and thinking of leaning on the John door in the 5 spot while she whispered a song along the keyboard to Mal Waldron, and everyone and I stopped breathing. Okay, this is called Personal Poem, and I beg to read it because it's very personal to me, too. Now, when I walk around at lunchtime, I have only 2 charms in my pocket. An old Roman coin Mike Kenemitsu gave me, and a bolt head that broke off a packing case when I was in Madrid. The others never brought me too much luck, though they did help keep me in New York against coercion. But now I'm happy for a time and interested. I walk through the luminous humidity, passing the house of Seagram with its wet and its loungers, and the construction to the left that closed the sidewalk. If I ever get to be a construction worker, I'd like to have a silver hat, please, and get to Moriarty's where I wait for Leroy and hear who wants to be a mover and shaker. The last 5 years, my batting average is .016, that's that. And Leroy comes in and tells me Miles Davis was clubbed 12 times last night outside Birdland by a cop. A lady asks us for a nickel for a terrible disease, but we don't give her one. We don't like terrible diseases. Then we go eat some fish and some ale. It's cool but crowded. We don't like Lionel Trilling, we decide. We like Don Allen. We don't like Henry James so much. We like Herman Melville. We don't want to be in the Poets Walk in San Francisco even. We just want to be rich and walk on girders in our silver hats. I wonder if one person out of the 8 million is thinking of me as I shake hands with Leroy and buy a strap for my wristwatch and go back to work happy at the thought, possibly so. Thank you. This is called Avenue A. We hardly ever see the moon anymore, so no wonder it's so beautiful when we look up suddenly and there it is gliding broken-faced over the bridges, brilliantly coursing soft. And a cool wind fans your hair over your forehead and your memories of Red Groom's locomotive landscape. I want some bourbon. You want some oranges. I love the leather jacket Norman gave me and the corduroy coat David gave you. It's more mysterious than spring. The El Greco heavens breaking open and then reassembling like lions in a vast tragic veld that is far from our small selves and our temporally united passions. In the cathedral of January's. Everything is too comprehensible. These are my delicate and caressing poems. I suppose there will be more of those others to come, as in the past, so many. But for now, the moon is revealing itself like a pearl to my equally naked heart. And the last of Frank's that I'll read is called Steps. How funny you are today, New York, like Ginger Rogers in springtime, or swing time, and St. Bridget's steeple leaning a little to the left. Here I have just jumped out of a bed full of V-days. I got tired of D-days. And blue you there still accepts me foolish and free. All I want is a room up there and you in it. And even the traffic halt so thick is a way for people to rub up against each other. And when their surgical appliances lock, they stay together for the rest of the day. What a day. I go by to check a slide and I say, that painting's not so blue. Where's Lana Turner? She's out eating and Garbo's backstage at the Met. Everyone's taking their coat off so that they can show a rib cage to the rib watchers. And the park's full of dancers with their tights and shoes and little bags who are often mistaken for worker outers at the West Side. Why? Why not? The Pittsburgh Pirates shout because they won and in a sense we're all winning. We're alive. The apartment was vacated by a gay couple who moved to the country for fun. They moved a day too soon. Even the stabbings are helping the population explosion, though in the wrong country. And all those liars have left the UN. The Seagram buildings no longer rivaled in interest. Not that we need liquor. We just like it. And the little box is out on the sidewalk next to the delicatessen so the old man can sit on it and drink beer and get knocked off it by his wife later in the day while the sun is still shining. Oh God, it's wonderful to get out of bed and drink too much coffee and smoke too many cigarettes and love you so much. He was great. One day when I was working in a, doing temp work, it was, I think it was right after Frank died. So I wrote a couple of poems called Lunch Poems in his memory. One, the departed ad exec has left a desk full, keys, slides, a colorful coffee-stained pressed paper Mexican poster, a frequent flyer book, and me, hired help, writing on her notepad five floors over Midtown Manhattan, while a band in the basement plays Epistrophe, and people applaud Thelonious Monk, who is dead, as they watch themselves in the towering glass walls, and rain puddles the tar paper roof of the old doomed building below me, where a weed grows and a white pigeon flutters off. And behind the windows, blinded by plywood, the past retreating, flies, living, dying. Thank you.
Thanks. That looks good. Well, we're not exactly following the program, so in case you're wondering, I'm Vincent Katz. And it's a great pleasure to be here to honor Frank O'Hara's poetry here in this setting. I think he's probably certainly one of the greatest poets of his time, if not the greatest. For grace, after a party. You do not always know what I am feeling. Last night, in the warm spring air, while I was blazing my tirade against someone who doesn't interest me, it was love for you that set me afire. And isn't it odd? For in rooms full of strangers, my most tender feelings writhe and bear the fruit of screaming. Put out your hand. Isn't there an ashtray suddenly there beside the bed? And someone you love enters the room and says, wouldn't you like the eggs a little different today? And when they arrive, they are just plain scrambled eggs, and the warm weather is holding. And now for some lunch poems. A step away from them. It's my lunch hour, so I go for a walk among the hum-colored cabs. First, down the sidewalk where laborers feed their dirty, glistening torsos sandwiches and Coca-Cola with yellow helmets on. They protect them from falling bricks, I guess. Then onto the avenue where skirts are flipping above heels and blow up over grates. The sun is hot, but the cabs stir up the air. I look at bargains and wristwatches. There are cats playing in sawdust. On to Times Square where the sign blows smoke over my head, and higher the waterfall pours lightly. A Negro stands in a doorway with a toothpick, languorously agitating. A blonde chorus girl clicks. He smiles and rubs his chin. Everything suddenly honks. It is 12:40 of a Thursday. Neon in daylight is a great pleasure, as Edwin Denby would write, as are light bulbs in daylight. I stop for a cheeseburger at Juliet's Corner. Giulietta Masina, wife of Federico Fellini, è bell'attrice, and chocolate malted. A lady in foxes on such a day puts her poodle in a cab. There are several Puerto Ricans on the avenue today, which makes it beautiful and warm. First Bunny died, then John Latouche, then Jackson Pollock. But is the earth as full as life was full of them? And one has eaten, and one walks past the magazines with nudes, and the posters for Bullfight, and the Manhattan storage warehouse, which they'll soon tear down. I used to think they had the armory show there. A glass of papaya juice, and back to work. My heart is in my pocket. It is Poems by Pierre Reverdy. And in the interest of time, I'm going to skip what is perhaps my favorite Frank O'Hara poem, A True Account of Talking to the Sun at Fire Island, which Kenneth Koch found in his belongings after his death. It was not published during his life. And we'll keep with the New York theme here. And I have to practice my French to read this one. Adieu to Norman. Bonjour to Joan and Jean-Paul. It is 12:10 in New York, and I'm wondering if I will finish this in time to meet Norman for lunch. Ah, lunch. I think I'm going crazy, what with my terrible hangover and the weekend coming up at excitement-prone Kenneth Koch's. I wish I were staying in town and working on my poems at Jones' studio for a new book by Grove Press, which they will probably not print. But it is good to be several floors up in the dead of night, wondering whether you are any good or not, and the only decision you can make is that you did it. Yesterday, I looked up the Rue Frémicourt on a map and was happy to find it like a bird flying over Paris et ses environs, which unfortunately did not include Saint-Étoile, which I don't know, as well as a number of other things. And Alan is back talking about God a lot, and Peter is back not talking very much, and Joe has a cold and is not coming to Kenneth's, although he is coming to lunch with Norman. I suspect he's making a distinction. Well, who isn't? I wish I were reeling around Paris instead of reeling around New York. I wish I weren't reeling at all. It is spring. The ice has melted. The Ricard is being poured. We are all happy and young and toothless. It is the same as old age. The only thing to do is simply continue. Is that simple? Yes, it is simple, because it is the only thing to do. Can you do it? Yes, you can, because it is the only thing to do. Blue light over the Bois de Boulogne. It continues. The Seine continues. The Louvre stays open. It continues. It hardly closes at all. The Bar Américain continues to be French. De Gaulle continues to be Algerian, as does Camus. Shirley Goldfarb continues to be Shirley Goldfarb. And Jane Hazen continues to be Jane Freilacher, I think. And Irving Sandler continues to be the balayeur des artistes. And so do I. Sometimes I think I'm in love with painting. And surely the Piscine d'Eligny continues to have water in it, and the Flore continues to have tables and newspapers and people under them. And surely we shall not continue to be unhappy. We shall be happy, but we shall continue to be ourselves. Everything continues to be possible. René Char, Pierre Reverdy, Samuel Beckett. It is possible, isn't it? I love Reverdy for saying yes, though I don't believe it. Having a Coke with you is even more fun than going to San Sebastian, Irun, Undai, Biarritz, Bayonne, or being sick to my stomach on the Travessera de Gracia in Barcelona. Partly because in your orange shirt you look like a better, happier Saint Sebastian. Partly because of my love for you. Partly because of your love for yogurt. Partly because of the fluorescent orange tulips around the birches. Partly because of the secrecy our smiles take on before people and statuary. It is hard to believe when I'm with you that there can be anything as still, as solemn, as unpleasantly definitive as statuary, when right in front of it, in the warm New York 4 o'clock light, we are drifting back and forth between each other like a tree breathing through its spectacles. And the portrait show seems to have no faces in it at all, just paint. You suddenly wonder why in the world anyone ever did them. I look at you, and I would rather look at you than all the portraits in the world, except possibly for the Polish Rider occasionally. And anyway, it's in the Frick, which thank heavens you haven't gone to yet, so we can go together the first time. And the fact that you move so beautifully more or less takes care of futurism. Just as at home, I never think of the nude descending a staircase, or at a rehearsal, a single drawing of Leonardo or Michelangelo that used to wow me. And what good does all the research of the Impressionists do them when they never got the right person to stand near the tree when the sun sank? Or for that matter, Marino Marini, when he didn't pick the rider as carefully as the horse. It seems they were all cheated of some marvelous experience, which is not going to go wasted on me. Which is why I'm telling you about it. And then we were asked the somewhat daunting request to read one of our own poems. This one was written 18 years ago, and it was definitely under the influence, but, you know, happily so. 30. I'm suddenly happy to become 30. It has a big sound to it. What have I done to justify being 30? Today is my birthday. Yesterday I had a wild party. There were fortunes and bread. This guy kept telling me my beads were Mexican. Alan quizzed him which city in Mexico. We listened to Charlie Parker, Rebel MC, and Athena arrived. We were all pleased, as I'd only invited her that day. Francesco and Alba left with Elizabeth, their dog. We saw open letter, performed You're the DJ, drank a lot, and danced sambas. Vonder whirled a white sheet about his head. I like birthdays because you really get to see what you are like. I like getting presents. I respect them to the extent I believe they were given. And I regard the presents I give exactly the same. Frank Lima is a class act, a bottle of Veuve. The shape and size and smell of the painting Hunt gives me all thrill me, even before looking at the painted image. Alan gives me songs of innocence and experience. When he arrived, about 12, he floated over to where I was dancing with Babs to P-Funk. He was wearing a very light white jacket over a blue shirt and white pants. He seemed very light. Today, I pushed Alice in the swings for a while. She is such a perfect girl. Now the day has dawned again on me for the 10,950th time. That doesn't seem like an awful lot of days when you add them up one by one. As I feared, everything looks the same except my eye, which has come to the understanding that some days are sacred. And to hold anything less than that is to be simply playing a part. Thank you.
I'm Dan Chasen from the Massachusetts delegation. It's unbelievably moving and meaningful to be here. So I want to thank everybody that Maureen O'Hara thanked, and then I want to thank Maureen O'Hara. This poem is called To the Harbor Master. I wanted to be sure to reach you, though my ship was on the way, it got caught in some moorings. I am always tying up and then deciding to depart. In storms and at sunset, with the metallic coils of the tide around my fathomless arms, I am unable to understand the forms of my vanity, or I am hard ally with my Polish rudder in my hand and the sun sinking. To you, I offer my hull and the tattered cordage of my will, the terrible channels where the wind drives me against the brown lips of the reeds are not all behind me. Yet, I trust the sanity of my vessel, and if it sinks, it may well be an answer to the reasoning of the eternal voices, the waves which have kept me from reaching you. This is a poem that I discovered in Mark Ford's wonderful edition. It's called A Party Full of Friends. I had never read it before, and it's become one of my favorites. Is this microphone okay? Yeah? Like that? Okay. A Party Full of Friends. Violet leaped to the piano stool and, knees drawn up under her chin, commenced to spin faster and faster, singing, I'm a little Dutch boy, Dutch boy, Dutch boy, until the rain very, very nearly fell through the roof, while from the other end of the room, Jane, her eyeballs like the crystal of a seer, spattering my already faunish cheeks with motes of purest colored good humor, advanced slowly. Pooh, said Hal, they are far too elegant to be let off the pedestal even for a night. But Jack quickly and rather avariciously amended, it's her birthday, then fell deliberatively silent as Larry paced the floor. Oh, Larry, ouch, he cried, the latter. The business isn't very good between Boston and New York. When I'm not painting, I'm writing. When I'm not writing, I'm suffering for my kids. I'm good at all three. Indeed you are, I added hastily with real admiration before anyone else could get into the poem. But Arnie, damn him, had already muttered, yes, you are, not understanding the fun of idle protest. John yawked onto the ottoman, having eyes for naught but the dizzy violet, and George thought Freddie was old enough to drink. Gloria had not been invited, although she had brought a guest. What confusion. And to think I sat down and caused it all. No, Leon wanted someone to give a birthday party, and Busby was born within the fortnight, the only one everybody loves. I don't care. Someone's going to stay until the cows come home, or my name isn't Frank O'Hara. This is, I was in fact too daunted to take the challenge of reading a poem of my own, so I'm just going to read this slightly long poem by O'Hara called In Memory of My Feelings. In Memory of My Feelings to Grace Hartigan, 1. My quietness has a man in it. He is transparent, and he carries me quietly like a gondola through the streets. He has several likenesses, like stars and years, like numerals. My quietness has a number of naked selves, so many pistols I've borrowed to protect myself from creatures who too readily recognize my weapons and have murder in their hearts. Though in winter, they are warm as roses. In the desert, taste of chilled anisette. At times withdrawn, I rise into the cool skies and gaze on the imponderable world with a simple identification of my colleagues, the mountains. Manfred climbs to my nape, speaks, but I do not hear him. I'm too blue. An elephant takes up his trumpet. Money flutters from the windows of cries, silk stretching its mirror across shoulder blades. A gun is, quote, fired. One of me rushes to window number 13, and one of me raises his whip, and one of me flutters up from the center of the track amidst the pink flamingos, and underneath their hooves as they round the last turn, my lips are scarred and brown, brushed by tails, masked in dirt's lust, definition, open mouths gasping for the cries of the betters for the lungs of earth. So many of my transparencies could not resist the race. Terror in earth, dried mushrooms, pink feathers, tickets, a flaking moon drifting across the muddied teeth, the imperceptible moan of covered breathing, love of the serpent. I am underneath its leaves as the hunter crackles and pants and bursts, as the barrage balloon drifts behind a cloud and animal death whips out its flashlight, whistling and slipping the glove off the trigger hand. The serpent's eyes redden at the sight of those thorny fingernails. He is so smooth. My transparent selves flail about like vipers in a pail, writhing and hissing without panic, with a certain justice of response. And presently the aquiline serpent comes to resemble the Medusa. 2. The dead hunting and the alive a hunted. My father, my uncle, my granduncle, and the several aunts. My grand aunt dying for me like a talisman in the war before I had even gone to Borneo. Her blood vessels rushed to the surface and burst like rockets over the wrinkled invasion of the Australians, her eyes aslant like the invaded, but blue like mine. An atmosphere of supreme lucidity, humanism, the mere existence of emphasis, a rusted barge painted orange against the sea, full of marines reciting the Arabian ideas, which are a proof in themselves of seasickness, which is a proof in itself of being hunted. A hit, ergo, swim. My 10, my 19, my 9, and the several years. My 12 years since they all died, philosophically speaking. And now the coolness of a mind like a shuttered suite in the Grand Hotel where mail arrives for my incognito, whose facade has been slipping into the Grand Canal for centuries, rockets splay over a Spozzolizio, fleeing into night from their Chinese memories. And it is a celebration, the trying desperately to count them as they die. But who will stay to be these numbers when all the lights are dead? 3. The most arid stretch is often richest, the hand lifting towards a fig tree from hunger, digging. And there is water, clear, supple. Or there, deep in the sand where death sleeps, a murmurous bubbling proclaims the blackness that will ease and burn. You preferred the Arabs? But they didn't stay to count their inventions, racing into sands, converting themselves into so many, embracing at Ramadan the tenderest effigies of themselves with penises shorn by the hundreds like a camel ravishing a goat. And the mountainous-minded Greeks could speak of time as a river and step across it into Persia, leaving the pain at home to be converted into statuary. I adore the Roman copies. And the stench of the camel's spit I swallow, and the stench of the whole goat, for we have advanced, France, together into a new land, like the Greeks, where one feels nostalgic for mere ideas, where truth lies on its deathbed like an uncle, and one of me has a sentimental longing for number, and has another for the ball gowns of the directoire, and yet another for destiny, Paris, destiny, or only a king may kill a king. How many selves are there in a war hero asleep in names, under a blanket of platoon and fleet, orderly, for every seaman with one eye closed in fear and twitching arm at a sigh for Lord Nelson, he is all dead. And now a meek subaltern writhes in his bedclothes with the fury of a thousand, violating an insane mistress who has only herself to offer his multitudes. Rising, he wraps himself in the burnous of memories against the heat of life, and over the sands he goes to take an algebraic position in re, a sun of fear shining not too bravely. He will ask himself to vote on fear before he feels a tremor as runners arrive from the mountains bearing snow, proof that the mind's obsolescence is still capable of intimacy. His mistress will follow him across the desert like a goat towards a mirage, which is something familiar about one of his innumerable wrists, and lying in an oasis one day playing catch with coconuts, they suddenly smell oil. 4. Beneath these lives, the ardent lover of history hides, tongue out, leaving a globe of spit on a taut spear of grass, and leaves off rattling his tail a moment to admire this flag. I'm looking for my Shanghai Lil. 5 years ago, enamored of fire escapes, I went to Chicago, an eventful trip. The fountains, the Art Institute, the Y for both sexes, absent Christianity. At 7, before Jane was up, the copper lake stirred against the sides of a Norwegian freighter. On the deck, a few dirty men, tired of night, watched themselves in the water, as years before the German prisoners on the Prinz Eugen, dappled by the Pacific with their sores, painted purple by a naval doctor. Beards growing and the constant anxiety over looks. I'll shave before she wakes up. Sam Goldwyn spent $2 million on Anna Sten, but Grushenka left America. One of me is standing in the waves, an ocean bather, or I am naked with a plate of devils at my hip. Grace to be born and live as variously as possible. The conception of the mask barely suggests the sordid identifications. I am a Hittite in love with a horse. I don't know what blood's in me. I feel like an African prince. I am a girl walking downstairs in a red pleated dress with heels. I am a champion taking a fall. I am a jockey with a sprained asshole. I am the light mist in which a face appears, and it is another face of blonde, I am a baboon eating a banana. I am a dictator looking at his wife. I am a doctor eating a child and the child's mother smiling. I am a Chinaman climbing a mountain. I am a child smelling his father's underwear. I am an Indian sleeping on a scalp, and my pony is stamping in the birches, and I've just caught sight of the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria. What land is this so free? I watch the sea at the back of my eyes, near the spot where I think in solitude as pine trees groan and support the enormous winds. They are humming l'oiseau de feu. They look like gods, these white men, and they are bringing me the horse I fell with on the frieze. 5. And now it is the serpent's turn. I am not quite you, but almost the opposite of visionary. You are coiled around the central figure, the heart that bubbles with red ghosts, since to move is to love, and the scrutiny of all things is syllogistic, the startled eyes of the dick-dick, the bush full of white flags fleeing a hunter, which is our democracy. But the prey is always fragile and like something, as a seashell can be a great corbeille if it wishes, to bend the ear of the outer world. When you turn your head, you can feel your heels undulating. That's what it is to be a serpent. I haven't told you of the most beautiful things in my lives, and watching the ripple of their loss disappear along the shore, underneath ferns, face downward in the ferns, my body, the naked host to my many selves, shot by a guerrilla warrior or dumped from a car into ferns, which are themselves journalières. The hero, trying to unhitch his parachute, stumbles over me. It is our last embrace. And yet I have forgotten my loves, and chiefly that one, the cancerous statue which my body could no longer contain, against my will, against my love, become art. I could not change it into history, and so remember it. And I have lost what is always and everywhere present, the scene of myself, the occasion of these ruses, which I myself and singly must now kill and save the serpent in their midst. Thanks.
I'm Philip Schultz. You know, I must say, in reading this book, I'm encountering a different poet from the one I remember. There's the great wit, of course, but there's also this terrific sense of vulnerability and love that permeates the poems, and underneath even that, a quiet sense of dignity that made me feel that I was reading him for the first time. Why I am not a painter. I am not a painter, I am a poet. Why? I think I would rather be a painter, but I am not. Well, for instance, Mike Goldberg is starting a painting. I drop in. Sit down and have a drink, he says. I drink. We drink. I look up. You have sardines in it. Yes, it needed something there. Oh, I go and the days go by and I drop in again. The painting is finished. Where's sardines? All that just left is letters. It was too much, Mike says. But me, one day I am thinking of a color, orange. I write a line about orange. Pretty soon it is a whole page of words, not lines. Then another page. There should be so much more, not of orange, of words, of how terrible orange is in life. Days go by. It is even in prose. I am a real poet. My poem is finished, and I haven't mentioned orange yet. It's 12 poems. I call it Oranges. And one day, in a gallery, I see Mike's painting called Sardines. anxiety. I'm having a real day of it. There was something I had to do, but what? There were no alternatives, just the one something. I have a drink. It doesn't help. Far from it. I feel worse. I can't remember how I felt, so perhaps I feel better. No, just a little darker. If I could get really dark, richly dark, like being drunk, that's the best. That's open as a field. Not the best, but the best except for the impossible pure light. To be as if above a vast prairie, rushing and pausing over the tiny golden heads in deep grass. Poem. I don't know as I get what D.H. Lawrence is driving at when he writes of lust springing from the bowels. Or I do. It could be the bowels of the earth, to lie flat on the earth in spring. It's okay. To lie flat on the earth in spring, summer or winter is sexy. If you feel it stirring deep down slowly up to you, and sometimes it gives you a little nudge in the crotch, that's very sexy. And when someone looks sort of raggedy and dirty like Paulette Goddard in Modern Times, it's exciting. It isn't usual or attractive. Perhaps DHL is thinking of the darkness. Certainly the crotch is light. And I suppose any part of us that can only be seen by others is a dark part. I feel that about the small of my back, too, and the nape of my neck. They are dark. They are erotic zones, as in the tropics, whereas Paris is straightforward and bright about it all. A coal miner has a kind of sexy occupation, though I'm sure it's painful down there, but so is lust of light. We can never have enough, but how would we find it unless the darkness urged us on and into it? And I am dark, except when now and then it all comes clear, and I can see myself as others luckily sometimes see me in a good light. In favor of one's time. The spent purpose of a perfectly marvelous life suddenly glimmers and leaps into flame. It's more difficult than you think to make charcoal. It's also pretty hard to remember life's marvelous. But there it is, guttering, choking, then soaring in the mirrored room of this consciousness. It's practically a blaze of pure sensibility. And however exaggerated, at least something's going on. And the quick oxygen in the air will not go neglected, will not sulk or fall into blackness and peat. An angel flying slowly, curiously singes its wings. And you diminish for a moment out of respect for beauty, then flare up. After all, that's the angel that wrestled with Jacob and loves conflict. As an athlete loves the tape, and we're off into an immortal contest of actuality and pride, which is love assuming the consciousness of itself. A sky overall. Medium of finding and founding not just resemblance, but the magnetic otherness that stands erect in the spirit's glare and waits for the joining of an opposite forces breath. So come the winds into our lives and last longer than the spear's sharp snake, crushed before it conquered. So marvelous is not just a poet's greenish namesake, and we live outside his garden in our tempestuous rites. The last of his that is on the vast highway. On the vast highway where death streams cheerfully in the sunlight and the enormous bands cast their 4 o'clock suspensions over the harbor, I am told of the infidelities of the Puerto Ricans and the meanness of the Jews by an Irish cab driver. It is good that there are so many kinds of us, so death can choose and even perhaps prefer he who casts the first shadow of the day on those who are trying to live till dark. I'm going to end with one of my own. It's a bad poem. I actually tried to write a minute poem, a poem off the top of my head. So the only purpose I'm reading this poem is this, to show you the contrast and how brilliant Frank O'Hara actually was. And I even took that first poem I read, Why I'm Not a Painter. I find his method almost impossible. It seems so casual, but there's such great warmth in his. Why I'm Not a Novelist. I am not a novelist, I am a poet. Why? Because my stories are too short. I always wanted to write longer, more interesting stories, but I can't. I also always wanted longer arms and legs, too. Lately, my stories are growing even shorter, so short that sometimes I can't find them. One day, I went out walking, and one of my least essential stories walked right past me without nodding. I wasn't insulted or particularly worried. I'm used to being ignored by the estranged parts of my life, as I often do my best to ignore them. This is one of the reasons my stories are so short. Novels are mostly little stories joined together by one or two large interruptions. Novels have so much to say, they never stop talking. Poems prefer more intimate conversations, mostly about what almost but didn't happen. Sometimes I walk up Fifth Avenue feeling all my unwritten stories jingling around in my head. That's when I want to travel to new exotic places and learn old languages. My poems are tired of being so sad, and so am I. Thank you.